Thomas Jefferson might as well have been born reading. This isn't necessarily because he was born wealthy and had the leisure to read. The social origins of the Jefferson family are actually something of a murk that only begins to dispel at the beginning of the 1700s, when his grandfather, Thomas, married the granddaughter of the Speaker of Virginia's House of Burgesses and lived to accumulate 1,500 acres just above the falls of the James River. 1,500 acres may sound impressive to modern ears, but it was actually small change beside the land acquisitions of Virginia's Tidewater families. Richard Lee, who arrived at Jamestown in 1639 with little more than the clothes on his back, died in 1664 as the owner of 13,000 acres. Robert Carter, who was known affectionately, or maybe not affectionately, as King Carter, parlayed his connections into 300,000 acres of his own, worked by 1,000 slaves. Jefferson's father, Peter Jefferson, plunged into the land acquisition frenzy with a will, acquiring local offices, sheriff, magistrate, then county surveyor, and a wife, Jane Randolph, who connected him to even more numbers of Virginia acres. It was probably his Randolph in-laws who opened doors for Peter Jefferson to acquire a patent for 1,000 acres to the west, in the Virginia Piedmont, adding other tracts as he went, while building a modest plantation on the Rivanna River, which flows south into the James River through Albemarle County, at Shadwell, just east of modern-day Charlottesville. And it was there that Thomas Jefferson was born in 1743. Jefferson described his father years later as being of a strong mind, sound judgment, and eager after information. And though, he said, my father's education had been quite neglected, he read much and improved himself. Well, that same defect would not be repeated in the case of Thomas Jefferson. When the boy was 9, he was dispatched to the Latin school operated by the Reverend William Douglas in nearby Northam Parish, then to the school of the Reverend James Maury, rector of Fredericksville Parish, where he had mastery of Latin and Greek fastened onto his mind. In 1760, when Thomas Jefferson was already 6 feet tall, Virginia had something of a reputation for producing tall men. George Washington was even taller. He was tall with reddish hair, large hands, and fabulously shy. And at that point, he was packed off to Williamsburg and the College of William and Mary. The College of William and Mary was chartered to serve as a perpetual college of divinity, philosophy, languages, and other good arts and sciences. It would be a place where young, white Virginia males could imbibe the principles of all human and divine literature, both in English and in the learned languages. Now, translated into modern parlance, what that means is that William and Mary encumbered its students with a curriculum heavy on the study of classical literature, rhetoric, logic, and ethics, based on textbooks written by somber Church of England divines, who may or may not have noticed that a complete revolution in the world of learning had been in process for half a century. When they were founded in the Middle Ages, the first European universities offered their students a vision of the world which was wrapped around two principles. One was authority. The path to truth, wisdom, and beauty had been laid down for all to see in two sources: the Bible, which offered direct divine revelation of truth, wisdom, and beauty, and the writings of Aristotle, which offered an understanding of truth, wisdom, and beauty based on what Aristotle had to teach about physical nature. Although the pious raised an eyebrow at Aristotle, who was, after all, a Greek pagan, Both of these sources were understood ultimately to be compatible. Those in search of truth, wisdom, and beauty therefore took themselves either to the Bible or to Aristotle to find out what they needed to know, and at the end of the process, you were deemed learned. At the end of all this reasoning sat an overall picture of the universe as a rational, reasonable place in which all the parts fitted together logically. The universe was, in short, and this is the second principle, a hierarchy. The physical universe was arranged with the earth at the very bottom, or center. And then, in ascending order of perfection, the moon, the planets, the stars, and finally, the firmament, the heavens, and the Empyrean realm where dwelt God and the angels and the saints. All these parts of physical nature were, in turn, held together logically by certain relationships to each other, based on their possession of certain intelligent or moral qualities. Qualities. Stones fall to the earth. Why? Because they share a common moral quality of baseness with the earth, which causes them to seek the base earth's level. Human society followed the same pattern of hierarchy, like a pyramid in which kings ruled over nobles, and nobles ruled over the commons, and in which the lower order served the next higher, and the higher orders were responsible for preserving and protecting the lower. And human society also was held in place by differing qualities and status. For instance, why did more peasants than kings die of smallpox? Ah, here's the answer. Because peasants are base by nature and inherently closer to the earth. That's why more of them die of smallpox than kings. These twin principles of authority and hierarchy gave European intellectual life stability for 400 years. It survived even the uproar of the Protestant Reformation in the 1500s, since Protestant intellectuals merely took over the two principles for themselves. And then, at the dawn of the 1600s, with a snap, it all cracked. Appropriately for cracking, it begins with lenses. The technology of lens grinding had finally achieved a level of finesse by the beginning of the 17th century that it could provide powerful new telescopes with which to behold the heavens. And when curious astronomical observers like Galileo Galilei looked through those telescopes, they did not see much there which looked like a hierarchy. The earth, of course, everyone knew to be deformed by mountains and other forms of uneven, illogical nastiness. But when Galileo trained his telescope on the moon, he discovered that the moon was even more uneven and disfigured. By Aristotle's reasoning, the moon, since it was higher than the earth, ought to have been more perfect in shape. It wasn't. Nor were the other planets. Nor, Galileo soon concluded, were the physical movements of the moon and the planets governed by moral relationships of superiority and inferiority to each other. Put a round ball on a flat plane, Galileo argued, and it will roll on forever, and without any concern for the occult qualities possessed either by the plane or by itself. Physical bodies have physical inclination to some motion, Galileo wrote. In whatever they are not impeded by some obstacle, they will just roll on forever. Or, put an object on a spherical surface concentric with the earth. It will be indifferent to rest and to movements toward any part of the horizon. No internal qualities, intelligent or moral, govern the ball. That ball, that sphere, would just keep on rolling because there was nothing to stop it. When Isaac Newton refined this to explain the movement of all physical objects in terms not of the internal qualities of objects, but in terms of a simple and entirely measurable force, which he called attraction at a distance, but which we call gravity, then the idea of the universe as a harmonious whole, with its various parts adhering to each other on the basis of their possession of intelligent qualities, went out the window. The universe, instead, became an assortment of material substances, governed only by faceless and indifferent physical laws and forces. And one no longer searched in the Bible and Aristotle for truth, wisdom, or beauty, but in the world of those substances and forces. And that, in four paragraphs, is what Europeans then called the new philosophy, and which we call the scientific revolution. It took no great length of time before Europeans began wondering whether the same rules which shattered the hierarchy of physical nature might not be applied to the hierarchy of human society. Were there natural laws of politics which paralleled the natural laws like gravity? The task of discovering such political laws fell especially to the Englishman John Locke, the Scot Adam Smith, the Italian Cesare Beccaria, and the Frenchman Charles-Louis de Secondat, the Baron Montesquieu. Let's start with Locke. Locke asked his readers in his Two Treatises of Government to perform a thought experiment. Suppose several of us were shipwrecked on a desert island. The first fact that would impress itself on us would be hunger. Where was the next meal to come from? We would need at once to begin harvesting fruit and berries, and then, long term, plant crops which we could harvest. Investing our labor in producing food from the land is what sanctions our calling this land our property. But another fact would soon impress itself on us, and that is that some people would rather steal other people's harvest or property than do the work themselves. So it would become necessary to improvise some form of social organization or risk descending into cannibalism and murder. Thrust onto our island, we are in what Locke called a state of nature. And in the state of nature, we're free to do whatever we wish. If we are successful, we manage to plant crops, hunt game, and build shelter. But in order to get security for our property, we have to leave the state of nature. We have to surrender a portion of that freedom we've enjoyed in the state of nature and enter a political society. The reason why men enter into society is the preservation of their property, Locke concluded. Men would not quit the freedom of the state of nature were it not to preserve their lives, liberties, and fortunes. And that, for John Locke, explained the natural laws of politics. Every society emerges as an organized whole because people need to look out for their property, not because some royal lawgiver imposes a divine order from the top down. No, no, no. Weary of living in a continual state of war, wrote Beccaria in On Crimes and Punishments in 1764, and of enjoying a liberty rendered useless by the uncertainty of preserving it, they sacrificed a part so that they might enjoy the rest of it in peace and security. So you see, there was nothing mysterious or occult about government. And whenever a society decays or is diverted from that basic purpose of protecting rights and property, the people who made that society can devise something entirely new in its place. Locke was perfectly happy for British society to remain a monarchy since he regarded the British monarchy as the mildest form of monarchy in the world. But there had always been more radical voices, arguing that monarchs of any sort were an unnatural imposition on the sovereignty of the people. And therefore, the only true and natural form of government was a republic. What was true for politics might also be true for economics. So long as society was conceived of as a hierarchy, kings were assured of the top spot, followed by nobles and the commons. The idea that there might be another class, composed of tradesmen and merchants and bankers, excited only disdain from the kings and nobles and resentment from the commons. But to Adam Smith, there was no longer any inherent virtue in kings or nobles. If there was any virtue to be found in human society, it was in that much despised commercial class, whose sober concentration on profit and trade was the real means of enriching everyone in society. Just as the protection of property explained to Locke the reason for government, trade explained to Adam Smith what made societies happy and prosperous. Commerce and manufactures gradually introduced order and good government, Smith wrote in The Wealth of Nations, and with them the liberty and security of individuals among the inhabitants of the country who had before lived in a continual state of war with their neighbors and of servile dependency upon their superiors. Montesquieu, in his Spirit of the Laws, agreed with Smith. Commerce, not kings, cures destructive prejudices, unites nations, and produces in men a certain feeling for exact justice. Taken together, this new understanding of society and the new understanding of the physical universe created what the Germans called the Aufklärung and what was known in English as the Enlightenment. But where, you may be wondering, where was the role for virtue in the creation of a Lockean society? James Blair, the first president of William and Mary, corresponded with John Locke, but little in the college's curriculum reflected that connection. And when Jefferson arrived there in 1760 as a student, the tiny faculty were preoccupied more with adapting the new sciences to the rule of the old logic rather than emancipating the sciences from the old logic. Jefferson's real education came from two sources with only tenuous ties to the college. One was George Wythe, under whom he studied law, and the other was Virginia's lieutenant governor, Francis Farquhar. Remember that Williamsburg was also the colonial capital. This is why Jefferson has exposure to the lieutenant governor. Farquhar was a man whom Jefferson respected as the ablest man who ever filled that office. Jefferson became part of Farquhar's circle and owed much instruction to the habitual conversations around Farquhar's table. How much that instruction revolved around Enlightenment polls can be seen from the first book list Jefferson compiled for a London bookseller, which ordered Locke on Government and Ouvre de Montesquieu. And there was also a much longer reading list he drew up a year later, listing Locke, Montesquieu, and Adam Smith. 36 years after that, his favorite reading suggestions were still Locke on Government, Smith's Wealth of Nations, and Beccaria on Crimes and Punishments. Thomas Jefferson had read his way into the Enlightenment. Enlightenment politics came easier for Americans than Englishmen because the history of the British North American colonies seemed to follow precisely the stages of social formation that Locke had described in the two treatises. That the British government would not only fail to understand that, But attempt from 1763 onward to govern the colonies as really they were just some kind of inferior segment of an imperial hierarchy. That not only compelled Jefferson to join the colonial resistance movement, but set him to work writing in 1774 one of the resounding statements of that resistance, a summary view of the rights of British America. "Our ancestors," Jefferson announced in good Lockean fashion, "possessed a right which nature has given to all men of establishing new societies under such laws and regulations as to them shall seem most likely to promote public happiness. They, the people, and not the king, are the real sovereigns of America. Kings," Jefferson explained, "are the servants, not the proprietors of the people." The reputation Jefferson earned from the summary view got him the ticket as one of Virginia's delegates to the Second Continental Congress. And it was there in 1776 that he was chosen to draft the most important statement of American defiance, the Declaration of Independence, using a portable desk which now resides in the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. The Declaration was Jefferson's finest statement of Enlightenment politics. We know a lot of these words. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, not as members of layers of a hierarchy, but as natural equals in that original state of nature, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." We were created with rights, not status or qualities. Rights which we receive directly from our Creator and not from kings or nobles. "That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." The needs of the people, not the decree of a divinely ordained monarch, form the basis and rationale of a government. "That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it." So, if and when a government loses its focus on serving the interests of the people are fully authorized, as that government's real makers, to unmake that government and form a new one. And the new government Americans would make would be a republic, shorn of kings and nobility. The curious thing about Jefferson's political eloquence is that Jefferson the man did not particularly care for politics or commerce once they had to be translated into everyday affairs. "Science is my passion," he once said. "Politics, my duty." And it was not a duty he found very agreeable. He declined re-election to the Continental Congress, but agreed to serve in the new Virginia Assembly from 1776 till 1779, when he unenthusiastically allowed himself to be elected governor of Virginia. He was right not to be enthused. The British staged a major invasion of Virginia during his tenure. The Assembly printed paper money with such abandon that by the end of his tenure as governor in 1781, its value had inflated from 12 and a half paper dollars to one gold dollar in 1779 to 250 paper dollars to one gold dollar. And when he left office, he had a resolution in the Assembly hurled after him calling for an inquiry to be made into the conduct of the executive of this state for the last 12 months. Nor can it be said that Jefferson was always consistent or even generous in his embrace of the Enlightenment's principles. In 1777, he had been the prime advocate of a statute securing freedom of religion in Virginia, and establishing that no man shall be compelled to frequent or support any religious worship, place, or ministry whatsoever, nor shall otherwise suffer on account of his religious opinions or beliefs. But it was not always clear whether Jefferson was advocating freedom of religion or from religion. He considered himself an Epicurean, which he defined as a belief that the universe was eternal and composed of matter and void alone, and that the highest good is to be not pained in body nor troubled in mind. He did not doubt that there was a creator of sorts, but to talk of immaterial existences is to talk of nothings. And he could be cruel to the point of mockery in describing other people's religion. "In our Richmond," he wrote sarcastically, "there is much fanaticism, but chiefly among the women. They have their night meetings and praying parties where, attended by their priests and sometimes by a henpecked husband, they pour forth the effusions of their love to Jesus in terms as amatory and carnal as their modesty would permit them to use to a mere earthly lover." Jefferson was also less enthusiastic about commerce. It was not merchants and trade, but cultivators of the earth who are the most valuable citizens, Jefferson insisted, writing to John Jay in 1785. And why? Because landowning is what guarantees virtue. And virtue was supposed to be the abiding concern of a republic. "Cultivators," Jefferson went on, "are the most vigorous, the most independent, the most virtuous, and they are tied to their country and wedded to its liberty and interests by the most lasting bonds. I consider," wrote Jefferson, almost in echo of Benjamin Franklin, the leather apron city dweller, "I consider merchants and bankers as the panders of vice and the instruments by which the liberties of a country are generally overturned. By contrast, those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God, if ever he had a chosen people. While we have land to labor, then let us never wish to see our citizens occupied at our workbench or twirling a distaff." But a far more sensational departure from the Enlightenment's denunciation of hierarchy and despotism was the fact that Jefferson himself was a hierarch and a despot, which is to say that he was a slave owner, and a large-scale slave owner at that. Jefferson inherited from his father both land and slaves, and after he married Martha Wales in 1772, the death of his father-in-law brought him an additional 11,000 acres and raised his total ownership of slaves to 135. He professed opposition to slavery. "What consistency," he asked, "is there in the statesman who, permitting one half the citizens thus to trample on the rights of the other?" Evidently, none. But that did not prevent him, after the death of Martha Jefferson in 1782, from taking a slave woman, Sally Hemings, as his lover. This was not quite the peculiarity it has since seemed. Hemings was, biologically, Martha Jefferson's half-sister. Both Sally Hemings and Martha Jefferson had the same father, and she was so light-skinned that years later she would be mistaken for white by a census enumerator. What was infinitely less forgivable was Thomas Jefferson's refusal to free Hemings from bondage, and his siring at least five unacknowledged slave children by her. What Jefferson did see clearly, however, was that the ramshackle structure of the Articles of Confederation was doing nobody in America any good. He half expected some two states to commit hostilities on each other, and that would finally cause the hand of union to be lifted up and interposed. In 1784, mourning the death of Martha Jefferson, Jefferson agreed to become the American diplomatic minister to France. And he found there that the non-payment of our debts and the want of energy in our government had seriously damaged the American reputation in Europe. But from far away in Paris, the real problem would seem to Jefferson to be the lack of virtue governing American affairs. And when he returned, it would be an appeal to political qualities other than virtue, which would arouse his lifelong ire.